Just a quick warning that we will be discussing the most intense things ever. So there's going to be talk of murder, abuse, very, very toxic masculinity, maybe toxic femininity, sexual abuse, child abuse, pedophilia, torture, hooks, blood, weird patriarchal conceptions of virginity, Eve, and how every single thing is apparently her fault and she's ruined the world. So much stuff. So this episode is definitely not a light one. And if you're sensitive to any of these topics, please skip these episodes.
Mercy me, the night is long. Mercy me, the night is long.
Welcome to another episode of A Hopeless Endeavor, a Joanna Newsom podcast. Today we are talking about Go Long. My name is Sam. I suppose I am one of your hosts.
And my name is Nikki. I suppose I am the other one of those hosts. You guys, I'm so nervous.
So we have to say right off the bat, because we've been stalling recording for like an hour already. We approached this episode much differently than a lot of the other episodes. So I think we usually both go at it at like a sentence by sentence, word by word analysis. And I have to be honest and say that I didn't do that at all with this song. I got very lost in all of the different interpretations of the Bluebeard myth in The Bloody Chamber by Angela Carter, in Bluebeard's Egg by Margaret Atwood. And then it was time to record. And here we are.
Yeah, so that's very similar to how I approached it too. Of course, we're still going to do the line-by-line analysis. I think that's really important.
Yeah,
it's just that we have less, I just feel less grounded. Like I feel like we have less concrete things to say. I have a whole bunch of questions. And this is also one of those songs that, because it's like such an allegory slash straight up reference to the Bluebeard myth, and like because we have all these like feminist interpretations of the Bluebeard myth in the background informing our understanding of the entire song and myth and all that stuff, like there is like a lot more big picture stuff going on with this song than there normally is, or at least than we normally talk about. And also, it feels like there are 17,000 moving parts. So there's all of the, like, I could have researched the Bluebeard stuff for another, like, actually semester long, just doing nothing but, like, researching Bluebeard stuff and still had stuff to learn. But then there's also, like, the colonialism stuff that you had talked about before, Sam, when we were discussing a little bit before we started recording. There's, like, the East and West stuff. There is, like, the, like, I don't even know what else, all sorts of different dynamics, like all the different kinds of like masculinity, femininity dynamics, just so much stuff happening that, and like references to like other albums and like just a lot of moving parts. So the way that we've made ourselves feel okay with going ahead with this recording is that we're going to do our very best. We're going to have a bunch of questions. We will express those questions explicitly. Maybe you guys can help us answer some of them. But we're just going to leave ourselves the space to come back to this episode if we need to, whether that be in bonus episode form or on the actual like main feed. Just that's what we need to say.
Yes. I also want to say that I read, and Nikki read, Bloody Chamber by Angela Carter at the suggestion of Melissa from Blessing All the Birds. So I would, if you have the time and the space in your life, to pause this episode right now. And it's a short story. It won't take you all day to read, or you can find an audiobook like Nikki did, but it is fucking incredible.
It's really good.
It's really, really good. And it informed so much of what I know about this song. Also, Blessing All the Birds has 5 or 6 posts related to Go Long that are all incredible. So if you want to skim through those, give those a really nice read. I think it would really help too. But obviously, if you don't want to do that, then that's totally fine too. We'll do our best to fill you in.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a long road ahead of us, you guys. We're going to back slowly, slowly down it. Yeah. Jesus. Okay. So I guess this is part one of an undetermined amount of parts, probably 700. We'll see.
I mean, it's like only skin when we just started recording. You didn't realize yeah. it was going to be an entire month of episodes. But it's also like the title track Have One On Me in the way that there was so much history.
Yeah.
And so much real life influence in that song that it was so overwhelming to research.
So overwhelming. Like even just reading the Angela Carter story, it's like, okay, well, that one's based on like the Perrault story, which is itself maybe based on an actual serial killer. Oh, but maybe it's not actually based on that serial killer because maybe that guy was being framed. Like there's like, you just like can keep going back forever and ever. And I guess that is kind of just the nature of folktales, which is sort of what makes them really compelling, or part of what makes them compelling to me at least. But yeah, like I guess let's just like take like a giant step back. Why are we talking about Bluebeard in the first place? Like how do we know that that is what she might be talking about here?
That's a great question, Nikki. I don't know, should we start with like just going over the general story of Bluebeard and like why it makes sense?
Yeah, I think that's good, because like just in us telling the story, that like the bare bones story of like the original Bluebeard myth or tale, I guess, you guys will be able to see the parallels. You're gonna like be like, oh, this is what Joanna was referencing. She's not just talking about a room full of gilded teeth because of no reason.
Okay.
Or beards still being blue.
Okay, so this is the synopsis of the Perrault, the original fairy tale from, what the fuck year is this, 1697 or something?
Oh, that sounds right.
Something like that, yeah, 1697. And this is just a synopsis from Wikipedia. So Bluebeard is a man, surprise, surprise.
Not a pirate.
Not a pirate. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. My partner made so many jokes about Blackbeard when I was researching this episode, and I was so annoyed. Like, it's nothing to do with pirates. I promise. Not a pirate.
Not a pirate. Mm-mm.
Some kind of very wealthy, noble man, noble person who has been married multiple times to beautiful women. And all of these women have mysteriously vanished. After his last, most recent wife dies, he very soon after visits his neighbor, asks to marry one of his neighbor's daughters. All of these daughters are not into it. The original story.
Terrified.
They're terrified.
Yeah.
But after hosting a wonderful banquet, the youngest of the daughters decides to be his wife, and she goes to live with him in his rich and luxurious palace on the countryside, away from her family, which is key. And these are themes that are common through almost all of these interpretations. So they're
wealthy
married.
Wealthy guy. Yeah. Yeah. Wealthy guy.
Yeah.
Gets this, like, young girl to marry him. They're married. He like takes her away to his palace castle thing by the sea.
Yeah. And like a young girl who is not on the same level, like economically as him.
Yeah.
Like that he lives in a world of excess and like treasure and riches that is something that's like just totally blows her mind. It's so tempting, I think, is a really important point too. So they're married. He announces that he must leave the country. In the Bloody Chamber story, I know it's for business in France. But in the original one, he gives the keys of the chateau to his new wife. She's able to open any door in the house with them, each of which contains some of his riches. There's like an office. There's like a place where he stores the jewelry. In the Bloody Chamber story, she's a pianist. So there's like a key to the room that the piano is in. Except for an underground chamber that he strictly forbids her to enter, lest she suffer his wrath. So this is very clear, right? Like, here's a ring of keys. There's 100 keys on the ring. 99 of them you can use. But this one, don't you dare. Like, you are not allowed.
Yeah.
He goes away. Leaves the house. Leaves her the keys. And in this version, she invites her sister and her friends and cousins over for a party. She is eventually overcome with the desire to see what the forbidden room holds, and she sneaks away from the party and ventures into the room. Do you want to read the next part here?
Oh, I'm not even on the Wikipedia page, but no, you just keep going.
She immediately discovers, upon using this secret key, the forbidden key, that the room is flooded with blood, and the murdered corpses of Bluebeard's former wives are hanging on hooks from the walls. Horrified, she drops the key in the blood and flees the room. She tries to wash the blood from the key, but the key is magical somehow, and the blood cannot be removed. Bluebeard, this is another important aspect, he unexpectedly returns and finds the bloody key. In a blind rage, he threatens to kill his wife on the spot, but she asks for one last prayer with her sister. Then, as he is about to deliver the fatal blow, her sister and the wife's brothers arrive and they kill Bluebeard. The ending to this one is that our now heroine inherits his fortune and castle and has the dead wives buried. And it's like a happy ending for her at the very least. Yeah.
So there's some intense shit there, obviously. Like Sam said, like those are like the bare bones of all of the like various retellings of this folktale are sort of just like loosely based on those bare bones. Sometimes the ending's a little bit different. Sometimes like the amount of keys given is different.
Sometimes the key is an egg.
Sometimes the key is an egg. I hadn't heard that one actually. Yeah. Oh, Bluebeard's egg. Is that?
Bluebeard's egg. And then there's this one called Fitcher's Bird, where the role of the key is an egg.
Right. Okay. So basic structure, all the same. Bluebeard is terrifying. But as we said, this was first published by Charles Perrault in a book called Histoire ou Conte du Temps Passé. And there's like speculation that this is actually based on a true, not story, but an actual serial killer. There's a guy named, what's his name? Charles, I want to say again, which is, I don't like saying that name in French because there's the R and the L too close together that makes my tongue not work, but let me just see here. Did you read anything about the actual guy?
I didn't read it about, I didn't know that it was, Guy Deray, century pedophile and child murderer.
Yes. Okay. So here's, I listened to like a 20-minute Stuff You Missed in History Class podcast episode about this guy. And like basically there are these rumors about him that make him seem like he could very well be the basis or the inspiration, I guess, for this story. But then like all of this should be taken with a grain of salt because it could just be that people had a lot to gain from this guy losing his reputation because he was super rich. And so it could be that he was just like framed for all this or that these were all rumors. But the rumors are that he would like basically not with his wives, but he would lure children into his palace and torture and kill them for fun, basically. And he like might have done this with up to 6,000 kids, which seems just bonkers. But he was like the richest guy. He was alive from not earlier than 1405 to 1440, a knight and lord from Brittany. And these are all like French folk tales too. And also, I thought it was interesting. Brittany is also the origin of the myth of the story of Ys. I'm pretty sure it was a... So it may or may not be based on him. This guy's a super rich, seemingly serial killer who would apparently have this dungeon where he'd keep his dead children that he had raped and murdered and tortured. So who knows? But he did get hanged for these crimes in Nantes. Starting with some really heavy shit here. So where do we go next?
I mean, this just blew my mind because as you were talking about this real life story, I was just reading like a synopsis of it on the New York Times. And Nikki and I had talked before recording about like how heavy the Lolita vibes are throughout this song, but especially in referencing the 15th century serial killer. Yeah. Man, in Lolita, Humbert Humbert references Bluebeard.
Really?
I just saw a note about it in this New York Times article and searched the text. And at one point he says, "Poor Bluebeard, those brutal brothers."
Wow. I don't know what brothers he's talking about, but...
It would be referencing the brothers of the bride.
The wife,
Who came and killed Bluebeard.
Oh, fuck. Humbert Humbert is like, I sympathize with Bluebeard because that's just who I am in the story.
Yes.
Fuck, man. Oh, that is really interesting, Sam. I'm grateful that you found that. Really cool.
That's what's so hard, though, is like now we need to stop everything.
Stop everything. Let's do a week of research about Nabokov. Yeah, it's a really challenging episode to record on because of all these fucking really interesting wormholes that we could go down. But it is really interesting that like all within this one folktale, before we've even started talking about Jana, we have the theme of like, I don't want to say pedophilia is exactly a theme, but the theme of like older and younger.
Yes.
Being present on this album. We have we'll get into it, but this like imbalance in power dynamics that might come from that age difference. It might come from like social standing or something like wealth or power. But there is this like power imbalance that we have talked about a bit, at least throughout this album so far. Certainly with Have One On Me, that was just like what was happening, right? There was like the king and then like the courtesan. Already before we've started talking about the actual song, there's just so many potentially interesting parallels.
And in talking about that power imbalance too, like at least in the Bloody Chamber adaptation, virginity is such a key to that. And that speaks to like purity and age and like whatever ridiculous gender dynamics are happening at that time. Because even in the original one, it's specific to mention that it is the youngest daughter who marries him. There's just so much.
There is so, so much. Did you notice, by the way, that Joanna gets a reference in the Wikipedia on Bluebeard? In like the cultural references. Yeah, they list Golong as a contemporary reference or whatever, cultural reference.
That's really cool.
Yeah, go Joanna. Yes. Also, did we say at the beginning of this, like, the Bloody Chamber that we're referencing is just, like, one of the retellings of the folktales by Angela Carter in, what was it, 79?
Yeah, 1979.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think we might have said that. I just wanted to make sure. One of the reasons it's so interesting to us is because it is sort of like a more explicitly feminist retelling of the story. Would you say that's fair, Sam?
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly at least easier for me, at least, to be like, oh, this is a feminist story. Especially like, oh, there's such good lines in it where she says something like,
"Oh, it's so good." I have a ridiculous amount of quotes that I took out of here, and then was like, "Oh my god!" Like,
let's just read them all because they're so good. I was on a run today listening to the audiobook, and I like literally stopped to rewind to listen to the part where she was like, "I realized it wasn't like the Bluebeard character I was afraid of; it was myself." And I was like, "Yes, yes, yes, yes!" So good. Okay. We're getting ahead of ourselves.
I don't even know where to go.
I know. I don't even know where to go to. Do you think like the best way to do this is to start reading the lines and then reference the stuff as it comes up? Or should we do more of a zoom out, I don't know, comparison with, what do we do? What is recording?
So, okay, I think we should probably start line by line only because we'll never get to it otherwise.
Yeah, okay.
Like, I think we could just talk about the bloody chamber for 6 hours and toss in a little Bluebeard's egg, and then people will be like, but what about the song?
Yeah, okay. So let's start with the lyrics. But, like, for sure, in doing that, we're going to be talking a lot about those things. So
this is a very loose structure. We're so sorry. It's a lot.
We told you at the beginning, this is hard. We're trying. We don't know what we're doing. Okay. All right. Okay. I'll just read the first paragraph.
Perfect.
So she sings and writes, "Last night, again, you were in my dream. Several expendable limbs were at stake. You were a prince spinning rims. All sentiments Indian given and half-baked. I was brought in on a palanquin, made of the many bodies of beautiful women, brought to this place to be examined." Sometimes I read it with the inflection that she sings it with. I'm like, no, it's not examined. It's totally examined. But swaying on an elephant, a princess of India. Okay. First things first, let's just acknowledge that she says Indian given here and that that's really not a good idea. It's pretty racist. Not pretty, it's just racist. Yeah, I think she's trying to like make a pun here with like the like sort of introducing us to this idea of toxic masculinity where she's saying like your sentiments aren't like genuine, like you take them back or whatever as soon as you give them to me. And then there's also this, to me, a little bit hard to decipher dynamic of like East and West happening in this song. And so I think that the term Indian given is supposed to be a pun in that it's supposed to mean both that masculine thing I just said and something about like since he was like raised in India or something, his sentiments were Indian given. But like it is not a thing that should have been said or written, and bad.
Yeah, and that's exactly what my notes say too. Like, I don't want to give this line a ton of attention because it's just gross and awful. And, you know, for someone who has such a way with words, like, I just unnecessary.
Yeah. So let's note that criticism and then talk about the rest of, I guess, the first verse.
I mean, my very first inclination is to talk about Only Skin and how dreamlike Only Skin was.
Yes. That's exactly what I have written down too. Yes.
Thank goodness for you. But then I get stuck too because I'm like, what does dreaming have to do with any of this? Like, there's nothing dreamy in the sense that it's like floaty and sweet and like imaginative and heaven like or something about any of this.
So my theory about this is sort of at least half informed by something that I believe Melissa said on Blessing All the Birds in one of her posts, where she's like comparing the way in which the Angela Carter story and Go Long deal with the Bluebeard myth. And she says, look, like in the Angela Carter story, it is a straight up retelling of the Bluebeard story. It is just that story, but like, you know, embellished with these like different details in this like amazing way in which this woman can write. In Goldlong, it seems to more be an allusion. She's more comparing the man in this song to Bluebeard and making all sorts of allusions to that folktale, but she's not actually giving us a retelling of it. Like she, as far as we know, like it's not as literal of a like, here are all the different bare bones, like skeletal forms of the folktale that we had talked about before. She just is really incorporating that into the lyric writing. And so with that in mind, I sort of think that like maybe especially at the very beginning of this song, she actually is describing a dream wherein this guy was like a prince and she was actually brought in on this palanquin. And in her dream, the palanquin was made up of the bodies of beautiful women. Like all that to me can be a dream here while still like it doesn't mean the whole song's a dream. It doesn't mean anything. It just like it sort of like tells for me, like speaks to how she might be even subconsciously thinking of him as this like threatening Bluebeardy force in her life. Yeah.
And I think it really alludes to a lot of the violence that is to come. Mm-hmm. We have several expendable limbs. We have a palanquin made of the many bodies of beautiful women, which I think could probably, if we're talking about just like a present day relationship or whatever, like we've talked about through the rest of the album, people you've kind of left in your wake, like maybe other women this partner has dated, just being like added to that, you know, thoughtless pile or whatever. But it does give us like a kind of a really clear hint at the awful shit that's to come.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree that this is like a very violent, again, beginning of the song. And I like even before, so like when I first heard this song, I didn't know the Bluebeard myth and I didn't know.
No.
Like just, you know, hearing the words for the first time, even then I was like, holy shit, like expendable limbs. Like, even without thinking, like, you know, there's this whole history of Bluebeard killing all his wives. And, like, that's, mm-hmm. you know, one reason why these limbs are expendable. But if you're just thinking about someone who treats women as, you know, whatever, like, conquests or things to be had or, like, disposable things or things that you cycle through or, like, whatever. You just go through a lot of women. Mm-hmm. That there is like this like super heartbreaking sense in which you're treating their bodies as expendable. Expendable is such a heartbreaking word there. Like, doesn't really matter if we lose them. They're not like in and of themselves worthwhile. It also reminds like when she describes the palanquin as made of the many bodies of beautiful women, like the word beautiful there sort of modifies women in a way that I'm wondering if it's important. Like, it would be just as fucking tragic and, you know, violent and disturbing to describe it as just, like, made of the many bodies of women. Mm-hmm. But, like, to use the word beautiful there in describing how these women's bodies were really draws our attention, I think, to the fact that, like, it's not a coincidence that these are all, like, beautiful women. It's that, like, that's what they're being used for. And that is, like, a main focus of our male person in this story.
Yes. And something that's common through, I'm pretty sure, every single retelling in The Bloody Chamber, it's mentioned very clearly that one of the women who was found in the chamber is a direct descendant of Dracula. And mm-hmm. as such is like especially beautiful in a very dark way. When our narrator, the young bride, discovers the bodies, there's like special attention paid in the Angela Carter retelling to what the bodies look like in their various states of decay, and even like approaching the like skeleton and the skull of one of these wives. I'm going to see if I can find that.
I'm so glad you said that part, because yeah, that I couldn't believe that part where I was like, holy shit. Like even the woman, the wife in the story, is describing the skull as being beautiful. It was so gruesome. It was like, even though like it had like, you know, decay had taken all the skin from the skull, you could see from the skull this woman was beautiful, and I recognized her from her skinless skull.
Yeah.
By the way, skinlessness, I think it's really important that Occident comes after this song. She's like waiting for him by the ocean with her no skin. She's making do with her no skin.
Yes.
Did you find it?
Not the specific part I want. Someone, I want to say it was Samir, but it might have been someone. I'm pretty sure it was Samir. Had made such a good connection. I think it was on the Facebook group to that skinlessness as it relates to Colleen and like the Selkie tales as well. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's something we'll get into more in Occident as well.
Yeah. One thing I'll just mention. Are you still looking,
Sam? I'm still looking. Go, go, go.
Okay. Yeah. One thing I'll just quickly mention while you're looking is this might be the first possible reference to Will Oldham. Mm-hmm. I never know how to say his fucking last name, but it's a dude who shares a label with Joanna at Drag City. He introduced her, I'm pretty sure, to Drag City. Like he, you know, showed the cassettes to whoever needs to see cassettes in order for them to sign her. Genius, by the way, for this fucking song is like more disappointing than normal. I mean, Genius has its really great things. I'm glad it exists as a resource, but I was just very disappointed with the entries on Go Long. At the end, it like speculates like Will Oldham, Joanna Newsom's ex-boyfriend, da 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 da. I'm like, just first of all, like we don't know that. Second of all, it is so not relevant to like the content of the song, which is what these annotations are supposed to be about. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just wanted to say that his stage name is Bonnie Prince Billy, and Prince here is a some people speculate at least maybe a reference to him. At the end of the album, at the end of this song, I mean, sorry, there are like specific references, not explicitly, but almost to like three different albums that he wrote. So it's less of a stretch than I would think it would be just because of those references at the end. But we'll get to it when we get to it. I just wanted to quickly flag that maybe something like that's happening there.
Yeah, someone mentioned that in the Facebook recently, too. So I don't think that it's that much of a stretch either. No. Okay, the skull. So our narrator has taken the forbidden key. Bluebeard, I think he's just called the Marquis in this, in the Bloody Chamber, has gone off on some fake-ass business to France. Because that's the thing with all of these stories. To New York? Yeah. Oh, right, because he has to get on a boat. He's in France. He has to get on a boat. That's the thing about all these stories is that, like, Bluebeard knows that, like, because she is a woman, she won't be able to, like, stop herself from exploring this forbidden space. That because he forbade her from doing so, that temptation will be too great. And at least in my mind, it's all, this entire scenario is contrived to justify the violence that will come.
Me too, in this like very fucked up way.
Yeah.
And it made me think of actually, so all of this at some point in the Angela Carter story. So exactly what you said, Sam, we like, you know, the pretense is that this guy is like on this business trip to New York. The reason he comes back really early, like right after the woman goes inside the forbidden room.
Yeah, he's
like,
not even gone a full night. He's back before dawn.
Exactly. He leaves to leave and then he doesn't leave and comes right back home. Like even the wife in the like the narrator of the Bloody Chamber is like, I didn't believe a word of it. Like, I as soon as he came back, she was like, I knew what this was about. He gave me this key because he knew what would happen. And she says, I think something about fate even, or like something about like determinism, if not in those words. But it really brought to mind in no provenance for me when she says, really like angrily sounding in a way that just feeds my soul. And she says, you with your arrangement with fate, like nodded sadly at this horse's sad assault on that steady old gate. Mm-hmm. Or her lame assault, sorry, on that steady old gate. But it like, it gives the impression of this, the guy like knowing what's going to happen. And like, even though he's not directly causing it to happen, like you kind of, if you're that like complicit in the goings on, like, you know that that's going to happen. Like, it's not like you're washing your hands clean of the like denouement of things, you know? Like, does that make sense? I feel like I'm being super not clear this episode.
No, I mean, it does to me.
Okay.
Okay. As my eyes accustomed themselves to the gathering darkness, I at last, oh horrors, made out a skull. Yes, a skull, so utterly denuded now of flesh that it scarcely seemed possible the stark bone had once been richly upholstered with life. And the skull was strung up by a system of unseen cords, sawdust and diamond.
Yes!
So that it appeared to hang, disembodied, in the still heavy air. And it had been crowned with a wreath of white roses and a veil of lace, the final image of his bride. And another line here that blows my mind is, one false step, or my poor dear girl, next in the fated sisterhood of his wives, one false step and into the abyss of the dark you stumbled. Like,
it's horrible. And you know what? That moment when, because in the Angela Carter story, throughout the story, this, the new wife, like the narrator of the story, is like, I guess jealous is the right word to use. Just very like, not a fan of the fact that this guy's been married a bunch of times before her. Yeah. And these women are all beautiful. And she's sort of just like insecure, I think, about that.
Yes.
And she like, at the first thing she's doing when she's left by herself in the house is she goes and finds like these like love letters from his previous wives. So she, there's like this like very like sort of combative vibe between her and the exes of this guy. But as soon as she walks into that chamber and sees these women who've been just fucking victimized in the most brutal way by him, she like has this complete, like, it's not explicit at all, but just the way she's talking about them, there's this complete 180 where she feels like a kinship with them, and she like mm-hmm. associates herself, positions herself as one of them instead of being, you know, in opposition to them. And I think that that's really important. I read somewhere in some of something that we read in preparing for this that that Go Long is very much Joanna feeling protective of herself, but also of other women and like the position of women more generally. And yeah, I just thought that was kind of a cool parallel between. Yeah, the reaction of that woman when she sees the corpses of these other women. She's like, oh, they're not my enemies. Like, they're actually the people. They're me.
Yeah, and we have this kinship based on unlocking this door, that this really simple temptation, you know, construed by this awful man, knowingly led us all here.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's so interesting, too, because, like, as you said, she finds these love letters because he kind of tells her to, like, in the bloody chamber. He says, like, this one specifically is the key to my office. Like, feel free. Go ahead. She finds pictures of the old wives. And it's just so fully construed and planned and horrifying.
Like a very contrived situation. And
yeah.
And even like in the Angela Carter story, the love letters are in this like secret compartment inside of this drawer. But like, you're right. The guy was like, here's free reign. Go make paper boats out of my documents that you find there if you want. And like send them my way to New York. Like, you know, do whatever you want as long as you don't go into that one room. And so you're right that like if – and by the way, like she's – this the guy goes away on their wedding night. And so she's like left with actually nothing to do, right? She's like, wait, you just fucked me like in the middle of the afternoon, which I didn't like. And now you're just leaving like that. And I don't know anybody here. I don't have any of my own shit here. Like I have nothing, which of course to me was. Go ahead. I was just going to say like reminiscent of like the leave me alone in this old palace of yours. It starts to get to me. I take to walking because like, what are you going to do? Like there's nothing to do.
I think it's such an important point too that he has a control. He has control over the space, over the place, over everything inside of that house. She owns nothing. It mentions specifically that she comes without clothes because the things that she has are so embarrassing because she can't. You know, it mentions that like her underwear had been darned a number of times, that like her dresses were from a number of seasons ago. And that like he provides her with furs and jewelry and all of that.
Yeah.
And without a working phone. Yeah. So even if she was to call for help, which she does try to do, there's no way he leaves her. That's such a good point, with absolutely no recourse for any of the actions that he like so thoughtfully plans.
Right. And like also this is obvious and like doesn't need to even be said out loud, but like no matter who you are or what situation you're in, even if I had all the shit to do all day and I was super busy, someone gives me a fucking ring of keys, says, do whatever you want with them except for this one. Don't, like, of course that's the one I'm going to be interested in. Of course. Like, that's not, like, a fault of, like, women or this particular woman who, like, succumbs to temptation and curiosity and, like, women are – none of that. Like, oh, anybody would be like, ooh, that's the interesting key. Obviously.
Yeah. And the same story could take place over decades, right? Like he could be gone for years and years and years and have the same premise could be in place. And, you know, she doesn't find the bodies for 25 years or whatever. But I think that you're exactly right. That it's just like curiosity is just a part of the human condition. And he knows that. And the events will play out as he has planned, no matter what.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
I don't even know where we're going with any of this.
I mean, all we can do is tell people what comes to mind based on the shit we've read and researched. Yeah. So that's what we're doing. And I hope it's okay.
Do we say what a palanquin is?
Yes, yes. Actually, we should have done that.
It's like the little thing that like people of rank would be carried in. I feel like it's in like the Disney movie of, oh my God.
Like when I see this thing, I'm like, I've seen that before, but like what context would I've seen that in before other than like a Robin Disney Hood? Movie? I don't know.
I feel like it was in Robin Hood.
It could have been. So it's just like
Yes.
It is in Robin
Hood? The king tiger in Robin Hood is like carried in a palanquin.
Good job, Sam. It's basically
there's a
picture...
bunch of different names for it.
Oh, yeah. Like the, what's the like?
It's also called a litter.
Litter. Yeah.
It's also called, let's see. It was used in like all over Asia, China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, throughout Africa.
So yeah, there's this
in
Eastern
Europe, obviously.
Yeah,
because they just took the idea from there.
So there's this like Eastern vibe that she is bringing into it, or at least trying to bring into it. I'm not sure how much she's intentionally being colonial with it. Like intention, like as a commentary, maybe. I really don't know. I feel ill-equipped to talk about it, even because I have such a deficient understanding of the East and West dynamic that's going on in this song. But yeah, basically just picture a box with like a roof on the box that someone like sits down in or lies down in. And there's like sticks coming out of the base of the box that people use to carry you. I don't know if that was a good description, but that's what a palanquin is. And of all those words that we were talking about that palanquin is synonymous with, I venture to say that palanquin is the most impressive one to fit into the lyrics of a fucking song.
And like, yeah, she probably would choose like the prettiest one of those.
Litter.
Yeah, and it's something that's covered too, right? Because it's like, it would be people of a certain economic and like political status, could be like some kind of royalty. Some of them are super ornate, some of them are not. But it's someone who like daren't walk, whatever the distance they're going, they must have people carry them, at least in my understanding.
Right. And I think in this context, in her dream, she's being brought, I guess, to India. To, in my understanding at least, to be examined by the prince, right? To like be like to see if she's like deemed worthwhile or like pretty enough to be the princess of India, to become his wife, his newest one at least.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I assumed happened in, like, when the story was originally written or even before then, that, like, when someone of a certain status was, a man of a certain status was searching for wives, it was never a love match. It was like a bring me all of your virgins and whichever one I want, I will pick and they will be mine. There's, like, that super strong theme of ownership, of control, and all of that gross stuff.
Yeah. And of like trophy wifing too, right? Like if I can have the hottest wife, that means that I'm like a worthwhile man that like, I don't know. It's very exhausting content. But yeah.
So in my interpretation of this like Eastern influence that we have only briefly mentioned. Just in this first verse, we have the palanquin, we have Princess of India.
An elephant.
An elephant. This became a lot clearer to me after reading The Bloody Chamber because in The Bloody Chamber, the heroine of the story is not the sister and the brothers, but it is actually the mother of the young bride. The mother of the young bride who is born in Hanoi in Vietnam and has, you know, gone through a bunch of wild upbringings. The quote here that I have is, and these are very much not politically correct because this was, what, 1967? But the way they describe the mother is as the daughter of a rich tea planter. Had fought Chinese pirates, had nursed a village through the plague, had shot a tiger with her own hand, and all before she was as old as I. So there's this like interpretation of the mother who eventually saves the young bride and kills Bluebeard as being, as kind of sourcing her strength from this history. And so I think that's kind of how I like to frame it. And only because that was only like, that was like the most straightforward influence I could find for this, other than like the, you know, zillions of interpretations of the Bluebeard legend.
Yeah. So I have really sloppy and like embarrassingly sloppy things to say on this, but like, these are the thoughts I was able to muster up on this theme that I can detect in this song and yet like not really piece together super clearly in my mind. So yes, my ears like perked up when I heard the description that you had just read, Sam, when I was listening to the audiobook of the Angela Carter story. Then I read something also on fucking who knows what website talking about just the origins and variations of the Bluebeard myth. And one of the things I was curious about is, like, why is he called Bluebeard? Like, and the explanation is, like, well, his beard was blue. And I'm like, well, that's a little weird. I'm pretty sure he wasn't using, like, manic panic to dye his beard blue. So what's happening? And one of the explanations I had read was that the description of Bluebeard as Bluebeard is meant to, like, denote him or, like, to illustrate him as an ugly person. So, like, he has this, like, facial, like, fucking abnormality, this blue beard that positions him as this other. Like, he's already kind of scary. But in the stuff I was reading, it was, like, what that might have meant to, like, whatever 18th century, is that the year in which the Perrault guy wrote it? What that might have meant to 18th century French writer is that this guy was just Asian and, like, had a different, like, a darker color hair than other people. And so, like, you know how, like, if you get, like, black enough hair hue, it can look sort of black blue?
Yes, as a child or as a preteen who considered myself emo, I very much bought that box dye with the blue sheen.
Yes, exactly. Like, black hair, but it's blue a little bit. Like, a blue sheen, I guess, is a good way to put it. So that was one theory, was that this guy was just Asian and, like, French people didn't fucking know how to talk about it. Another interpretation was that in some parts of Asia, I guess, it would be a practice for people to dye their beards, like, deeper, like, a darker color. And so, like, maybe that's what made him look different. But both of those interpretations were sort of, like, East themes that might have been present in that original Bluebeard myth.
That's really interesting and makes me question, like, the original story it was based off of, too. Because at this time, at the time that the original one was written, it just kind of shakes up my understanding of it a little bit. Because it seems like if we are othering Bluebeard because of where they were born or whatever, that that kind of puts, like, a certain spin on the rest of it. A certain spin that is, like, super racist and is, like, this, these acts of violence are attributed to a certain group of people. I didn't know that. I didn't go any further than that, like, his beard was blue and that it had, that there was something othered about him. Right. And because of that, it was harder for him to find a bride. So it was, like, his wealth that convinced women to come to him. That's really interesting. I'd love to research a little bit more about that.
Me too. I'm actually going to write things down that I want to, like, follow up on in future episodes. And I'm writing down, like, racism in original, just to look into that more. Because I think you're right. I'd be, like, I think it would be the least surprising thing ever to find out that that original version was, like, permeated with racism.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, one thing that I don't even know what to make of is that I'm pretty sure, unless I'm making this up, that Charles Perrault, I think, also wrote Beauty and the Beast. So the guy who wrote the Bluebeard folktale, I'm pretty sure also wrote Beauty and the Beast. And obviously that's, like, the story, at least from my childhood, of a person being othered. For what they look like. And in that tale, I think we're sympathetic towards Beast, right? At least in, like, the Disney version, where, like, he is othered in this way that makes him go into solitude and have these, like, very, like, masculine, toxic masculine traits where he's, like, aggressive and shuts everybody out because he's been othered. And I think that, like, the most charitable interpretation is that, like, look, this guy's been othered and, you know, as a result has fucking lost his mind. Is it right, though, that he wrote Beauty and the Beast?
Unfortunately not, but it is a French novelist within the same like century. Okay. So I think that that like the same influence of othering is probably pretty likely.
Okay.
Beauty and the Beast author is Gabrielle Suzanne Barbeau de Villeneuve.
All right. Perrault wrote Sleeping Beauty. Maybe that's what I was thinking of. And Cinderella, actually. And Little Red Riding Hood. And Puss in Boots.
So then there needs to be, I wish we had had time to do like a greater analysis of all of those.
Yeah.
Because those all have a Prince Charming too. Like
interesting.
What made this original author, and maybe it was just that like original real life serial killer that influenced this one. What made him write about Bluebeard one way and Prince Charming? Yeah. Another way.
That's a great question. And it actually reminds me of something that I want to say this is Rachel Parent. Or no, maybe it's somebody named Anna.
On Blessing All the Birds.
Yeah, sorry. On Blessing All the Birds, there's this one of the Go Long posts is called Perrault's Bluebeard and Newsom's Go Long. And then sometimes I have a hard time on Blessing All the Birds finding out who the author is of the post, but right under it, it says in like square brackets, it says Melissa's note. : I love Anna, that is all. Mm-hmm. And then the first line of the essay is, this essay is intended as a companion piece to Melissa's brilliant work. So I guess this is not by Melissa, but I'm not sure who it's by. Maybe Anna.
I think this one's by Anna. Okay. I think if you go back a page, it just says by Anna, who's... it's also like in the section of the website where there's a bunch of different authors.
Okay.
And it's not just the regular contributors. So I think that's a fair assumption.
Okay. I just got to it from Google. So for me, there is no like page before this one. But okay. No, that's helpful. So in here, she writes something that I found really surprising. So here's a quote from Perrault, the guy who wrote the original Bluebeard. "It is easy to see that the events described in this story in Bluebeard took place many years ago. No modern husband would dare to be half so terrible, nor to demand of his wife such an impossible thing as to stifle her curiosity. Be he never so quarrelsome or jealous, he'll toe the line as soon as she tells him to. And whatever color his beard might be, it's easy to see which of the two is the master." And Anna writes, "I'll admit that I was surprised when I read this. Perrault's attitude seems liberal and empowering for its time, incredulous of the notion of stifling a modern woman's curiosity," which does seem super out of character because of like all these like Prince Charming stories. And like also it seems like there's like some moralistic theme to like the original Bluebeard story, which is like women don't be so curious, or like being so curious will get you in trouble or something. But she goes on to explain why this is probably a problematic attitude anyway to have, which is like, of course men wouldn't be abusive in the 1800s. It's the 1800s. Come on. Everything's great. But anyways, yeah. I don't even remember how I got talking about any of this. But
no, I think that's really interesting. And maybe just kind of proves that like the real awful pedophile murderer was more of an influence if it wasn't like Perrault's attitude at the time.
Yeah.
I don't know either.
I don't fucking know anything. All right.
Okay, so that's the first verse. One hour.
Okay. Oh, you guys, what a crazy time this is going to be. Okay.
The only other note I have is spinning rims. And I know that we laughed about how when you Google spinning rims, it's just like literally the parts of a car. But I like to think of it too as like spinning tails, like weaving a web of lies, something like that. Which are sentiments that are half-baked as well. And really just like weaving the entire situation and having practice in doing that, right? Like the number of wives that he killed, that he murdered, were, the number of them is different in all of the stories, but I think it's at least 8. So by this point, whichever version we're in, he's very practiced at this. He knows exactly what he's doing. Yeah, and I wonder how much his, in like a really dark way, his the process of doing this has changed from one wife to another.
Yeah, he's like refined his methods. Like,
yeah,
that's super dark. So when I originally looked up spinning rims, it was like, as Sam said, those fucking, I think, really douchey, like, wheels that look like they're moving when the fucking car is sitting still, whatever.
It's like that MTV show, Pimp My Ride.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is. I don't like them. But that's just me, to each their own. So I couldn't, like, even with, like, you know, what I consider fancy Googling, which is, like, putting things in quotation marks and then, like, minus car or, like, minus, you know, Pimp My Ride. I still couldn't find anything. But I just, right now, as you said, like, I don't know, something about, like, the what you said when you were talking made me think of, like, oh, wait. Because, like, I had given up. I was like, I don't fucking know what spinning rims is. Something impressive, I guess. But when you were speaking, I was like, wait, what if it's spinning plates? And I just looked up spinning plates as you were talking, and it looks like it is a common, or was at least a common, like, circus type of trick in, I have, like, China, Sri Lanka, another China one, just on the Wikipedia page, Thailand. So, like, maybe this is another sort of Eastern reference or something.
Like that idea, in that if you're weaving this web of lies, it is like spinning plates, and that, like, you have to focus all of your attention on what the plate is doing.
Yeah.
So to, like, weave this web of distraction around the young bride is to, like, blind her to everything else that's going on. And that's another commonality that's so true in all of these interpretations, is that, like, there were warning signs.
Yeah.
Like, she said to herself in the Bloody Chamber retelling, his bride was only died in a boating accident 3 months ago.
Yeah.
Like, how strange is it that he's so ready to be married again? Like, in every single story, there's these instances of, like, a foretelling.
Yes.
There's these warning signs that are ignored. And I love that spinning rims idea, that you're blind to whatever else is going on because you're so focused on the furs and the jewelry and exploring the castle, and, like,
you're so dazzled by, like, the tricks he's putting on. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. It also, when I'm looking at the pictures too of people spinning plates, like, masterfully, you know, it's often, like, they're, like, plates on, I want to say, like, sticks. Just, I don't know how to describe this, I guess. But basically, there's, like, it's almost like a form of juggling, right? Where, like, you have to pay attention to, like, 50,000 different plates that are going on at the same time and to try to keep them all in the air. And that just, like, I like your interpretation better. But what I had initially thought of is, like, you know, to keep all these, like, balls in the air / like plates in the air, like, maybe there's, like, a bunch of different women who are being, like, he's having to, you know, tend to, like, all these different, you know, women who he's stringing along. But no, I like the idea that she's just dazzled by him and ignores these warning signs. So it's not as though she's faultless, which, again, is, like, a theme throughout Have One on Me that we've talked about, where she's not blameless in this story. And it's super refreshing to see that.
And that's a hard one, too, for me, is that, like, I also don't want to blame her in this story, because it's, like, who wouldn't want to be swept away on this, like, romantic, super, like, intricately beautiful, you know, fairy tale.
Yeah.
But
especially,
I like
when
that
you're
idea.
Poor, like, you know, she, like, her family's struggling. Like, there's this.
Her father's dead. Father's I don't think dead. We mentioned that, at least in the Bloody Chamber story. And that, like, is a huge deal in that, you know, that would be the breadwinner of the family in 1697, and would probably affect, like, her marriage status in this really awful way.
Right. Yeah, I think it was, like, that the mom was born into, like, a somewhat rich family in Asia, and then decided to like forego her like familial riches to get married to someone who was like less wealthy, like i.e. the dad. And then the dad goes and dies in a war, was it?
I don't even remember.
It's probably not even important, but yes. So like I don't mean to say that she's blameworthy for like making that decision, but like
no.
You know, it's not as though the signs weren't there at least.
Yes. And that in each instance, you know, there was at least like a hint of like, oh no. Like
maybe not the best idea. Like also I was very intrigued by in the Angela Carter story,
mm-hmm.
by the woman's motivation other than just to get herself out of poverty. Because mm-hmm. the mom at the beginning of the Angela Carter story is saying, are you sure you love him? Mm-hmm. So she's putting on this pretense and she like avoids answering the question. But like she also does seem to be intrigued by him. Like she talks about him as having this like heavier gravity than the rest of us are gifted with. Like he like has this presence and this commandingness and this, she's like intrigued by him. But what I thought was maybe interesting too is that throughout the story, it's not even him per se that she's intrigued by. Like when he leaves, she's like, oh, I just want him to come back. Like, I can't believe he left me. Like, I want him here. I wish I had someone to talk to. But like, do you though? Like when he's here, you don't talk. You don't know anything about him. Like the mm-hmm. most she knows about him is when he orgasms. And she's like, oh, maybe that's when he's dropping his mask. So like,
yeah.
I think what she's more into is this like idea of like a husband. Like back to that thing that I said before, that quote from Carter where she says, like, I realized I wasn't afraid of him. I was afraid of me. It's almost as though like the thing that I was afraid of was being alone with myself and like not having something to work towards anymore, right? To like get married. And it makes me think of the I'm no longer afraid of anything save the life that here awaits. Like, so like now that I've gotten away from you, like being alone is really scary.
Being alone is really scary. And, you know, being alone in a place without in a place that's so different from your entire life, from everything else that you have known, to have like the castle has a staff.
Yeah.
And she's expected to. I loved when you mentioned like the juggling of the plates too, because it's like all of a sudden she's in this like very formal role.
Yeah.
And she's expected to know what to do. And you know this about me, Nikki, but I have been listening obsessively to You're Wrong About the podcast.
Yay!
Specifically the Princess Diana episode.
Yes.
And that's another example of someone who is expected to know
yes.
exactly what to do with this like incredible amount of power and prestige.
Yes.
And they didn't train her for anything.
No.
Nothing.
And then they judge her so harshly and like punish her for not knowing what to do when no one's fucking told her what to do. And like yeah, these weird rules. Yeah.
They just assumed that like because she came from a certain like pedigree from a certain family that she would know what to do with a prince, and like she had no fucking idea. Yeah. And he didn't help her because he was a man baby.
Yes.
Like he didn't do anything for himself. God, that's such a good series.
It is.
Thank you so much for telling me about it. Oh my God. It's like the first thing I listen to in the morning. Yay! The first thing as soon as I'm off of work, I'm like, I have to finish it. I only have like an episode and a half left, and it's the one about the murder, and I'm like, I know this is a conspiracy theory. I know they killed her. They had to have.
I actually don't think they do. One thing that is so whatever. Go, all of you guys, go listen to You're Wrong About the podcast. It's so good.
Yeah.
They're so good at staying grounded because, like, after all that, you're like, the royal family fucking hates her. But I'm pretty mm-hmm. sure it ends up being like, you know, the Sarah Marshall and Michael Hobbs just being like, yeah, like, I get why that's a conspiracy theory, but probably what happened was the guy was drunk and drove really fast where he shouldn't have been. Like people in power treating themselves as though they're exceptions to like these rules of nature.
Expendable
and like,
too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. One more thing before I do the next verse.
Yeah. Yeah.
I swear we can move on. Is that in this other retelling of the story. As we were talking about, like, the signs, the warning signs that were there, there's this other one called The Robber Bridegroom, which is a German fairy tale by the Brothers Grimm. The warning sign comes in the form of a bird.
Oh.
A bird in a cage. So it says, a miller wishes to marry his daughter off, and when a rich suitor appears, he betroths her to him. One day the suitor complains that the daughter never visits him. He tells her that he lives in the forest and overrides her reluctance to visit by telling her he will leave a trail of ashes so she can find his home. She fills her pockets with peas and lentils and marks the trail. It's a very Hansel and Gretel-y vibes in this one. They lead her to a dark and silent house. A bird in a cage calls out, "Turn back, turn back, thou bonny bride, nor in this house of death abide." Just another example of, like, going forward with something, even though you are not feeling it in, like, the lightest sense. Like,
yeah.
The signs are there. It's saying, don't do it.
It's going against, like, your gut and actually, like, I think...
Your intuition. Yeah.
Right. And I think especially as women, like, we are taught to think that our intuition or our gut feelings are, like, these, like, very, silly women feelings, yeah. Right? Like, that we shouldn't be taking them seriously. But, like, those are things that fucking matter. I hope that that's a theme the original Pelo story. I hope he was a secret feminist and he just wanted us to all know that. Pay attention to your
and
gut
that's
feeling.
The takeaway. Yeah. If you feel like it's bad, don't do it.
I'd be stoked on that. Okay. I know you had just promised that we'll move on.
Let's just throw any structure for this episode
out the fucking window. Yeah, we're done with structure. I just found that line that I had, like, not quoted but, like, have referenced twice now, so I feel like I need to read it just because she's such a fucking good writer. Okay, so.
Oh, my God. I wish we could just, like, read an entire episode of reading the whole story.
Okay, so she says, "I felt giddy as if I were on the edge of a precipice. I was afraid. Not so much of him, of his monstrous presence, heavy as if he had been gifted at birth with more specific gravity than the rest of us. The presence that, even when I thought myself most in love with him, always subtly oppressed me. No, I was not afraid of him, but of myself. I seemed reborn in his unreflective eyes, reborn in unfamiliar shapes. I hardly recognized myself from his descriptions of me, and yet, might there not be a grain of beastly truth within them? And in the red firelight, I blushed again, unnoticed, to think he might have chosen me because, in my innocence, he sensed a rare talent for corruption." It's just like, fucking God, how do these people, Joanna and Angela Carter, write so fucking well? I mean,
I want to tie that corruption to, like, the loss of virginity specifically in this story, because that's such a huge part, especially because he said that none of his other wives were virgins. And there was, like, a specific, I feel like that's the reason he chose her.
Mm.
And it also makes me wonder if in the most Nabokov Lolita influenced way, his brides are getting younger and younger as he goes.
Right.
And, like, I grossly pointed out before that, like, maybe he's just, like, improving his methods of corruption and murder and all of that disgusting shit.
Yeah, he's like, it's easier to do it when they're younger. Like, it's easier to, not get pushback from them. Yeah. It also speaks to, like, what he's actually after in these women. I mean, no one is under the illusion that he's into, like, their, like, minds or personalities. We know that. But I think it gives us a little bit more insight into the fact that, like, these Bluebeard characters are into, or at least this one in the Carter story, is into not just the killing, not just, fucking a virgin. But also, like, this really, to me, dark desire to corrupt someone's innocence, to, like, steal it from them. And you get that when he's like, look, all I'm doing is giving you this key, and, like, you could stay totally innocent. So, like, when you inevitably use this key that I'm giving you, like, it's your fault, and that's the thing that takes away your innocence. Like, it's not me it's not even like him taking it away from her. It's like making her give it to him, as though innocence is like a thing that can be given. But like still.
It's so manipulative and so intentional.
Yes. And disgusting.
Oh, it makes me feel the same way I did after I read Lolita. Like,
And it to me might give us some insight into the way that our narrator in Go Long is sort of maybe now that she has maybe a bit of perspective on the relationship, reevaluating what this person actually was getting from the relationship in the first place. Like, she might have thought that like this is an actual like mutual, like even though there's an age difference or whatever is going on, maybe it's like still a mutual relationship where we're like we're respecting each other and whatever. But to paint it with this paintbrush makes it feel like, oh no, I actually now realize that what you were doing was something totally different than what I was doing. What you were trying to get out of this relationship is something that I didn't know, maybe.
One thing that's really interesting too about the Margaret Atwood retelling, which is another short story, I think it's 1983, is that the roles are kind of switched. Only in that, like, the main character kind of sees her husband as, like, an idiot and kind of, like, as someone who isn't that bright and maybe doesn't see the full picture and assumes that, like, she has some kind of control or power over him. But I'm sure we'll get into that.
Super interesting. I want to fucking read that. I actually don't think we're going to get through this whole song today, so maybe I will read it before we can record again.
Yeah. Let's give ourselves another week.
Yeah. I'm actually down to do that if you are too.
Oh, totally.
Okay, cool. Because, like, we are one verse in and there are, like, 17 in this song, I feel like. Okay, so that does it for the very first part of Go Long. You guys know the drill. We have an email, hopelessendeavor@gmail.com, a Facebook group, an Instagram, Hopeless Endeavor podcast, I think. Hopeless Endeavor podcast. We have a Patreon. You should check it out. We have bonus episodes there. So I will link to the Patreon in the show notes. Thank you guys so much for listening. And just maybe let's brace ourselves together for this very in-depth endeavor that we have ahead of us in Go Long. We'll see you guys next week. Bye.